ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, look, it has been quite a year, hasn't it, Hamish?
It certainly has. The global news cycle has kept us on our toes.
From high-level diplomatic meetings to historic jewellery heists, there have been some truly unforgettable moments.
And some significant moments in global history, I think it's fair to observe. So on this episode, we're looking back at the lot, the highs, the lows, the in-betweens, and some hints maybe of what's to come in 2026.
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Hamish McDonald. Let's get started with a look back on the year.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
During his inaugural speech, the new president promised to usher in a golden age.
This is what victory feels like. Yeah!
Now, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has left the White House early after a bitter exchange with US President Donald Trump.
You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III.
A brutal end to a punishing week.
US markets have suffered the heaviest losses, with trillions of dollars wiped in the wake of Donald Trump's wide-ranging tariffs.
This week, Donald Trump made one of the dumbest decisions he's ever made as president, and that is saying a whole lot.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, here in Rome to cover the papal conclave with my colleague, Noel Debien.
And just like the movie Conclave, the cardinals are, of course, gathering, and we're hearing all sorts of leaks coming out of those general congregations, which show the drama of Conclave is not too far off.
Blasting off and bound for Israel. Iran fires back at its rival as both sides trade missiles for an eighth day.
People ask me, are we targeting the downfall of the regime? That may be a result.
It appears from what we've just seen that Vladimir Putin has fooled yet another US president, this time Donald Trump.
He also earned a new nickname from NATO's Secretary General, who described him as Daddy.
Let him fight for about 2-3 minutes, then it's easier to stop him.
And then Daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
It's our worst fears being realised, really. We've been warning about this for months, that famine was a risk here in Gaza.
It is a famine that hits the most vulnerable first. Each with a name, each with a story.
Huda worries she might not have much time left.
I need food and water. I need meat and eggs. And I ask you to get me out of here so that I can be treated.
Charlie Kirk has been killed. He was fatally shot while at a university in Utah.
Everyone started ducking down and started screaming, run, run, get down, get down. And so that was when I started hearing people crying.
My husband, Charlie, he wanted to save young men, just like the one who took his life.
Well, it's hard not to be completely captivated by these images of Gazans dancing on the streets, celebrating, some of them being pulled out of tents in their temporary accommodation to be told a peace deal has been agreed between Israel and Hamas.
Yes, I think it's an extraordinary day. And look, there's a lot to come, but in a way that doesn't matter. Of course, there's a lot to come. Just to get to this day, I think is an extraordinary event.
Just come out of a big meeting with Donald Trump.
Now, while Mr. Albanese escaped unscathed compared to other world leaders who visited the White House, there was an awkward exchange when a reporter asked about the Australian ambassador Kevin Rudd's past criticism of the US president.
Where is he? Is he still working for you?
Yeah.
You said bad?
Before I took this position, Mr. President.
But I don't like you either.
Name is Mamdani. M-A-F-D-A-N-I. The name is Mamdani. M-A-F-D-A-N-I.
The Big Apple was last week transformed into a pink O-lady with a democratic socialist seizing power in the richest city in the world and vowing, horror of horrors, a touch of wealth redistribution.
I will wake each morning with a singular purpose: to make this city better for you than it was the day before.
Developing this morning, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth announced a new mission expanding the operation targeting narco terrorists. The announcement follows the 20th U.S. military strike to take out drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean.
And I think the message from the administration there is these are foreign terrorist organizations. The rules of engagement have changed.
Vladimir Zelensky in London, another stop in his elusive quest for peace.
And there's growing worry that President Donald Trump's patience is wearing thin.
If we default to the old ways of America's just going to be the big idiot with a checkbook, that's not going to work.
Well, I think for me, a standout of this year, Geraldine, is the frequency with which you have taken sharp intakes of breath.
Yes, I must say, shock has registered on my face and in my lungs many times. And that's why I feel this is such, has been such a huge year, more than usual, because I think I have been forced. You know, I like things to puddle along and to have a sense that that I've got an idea where things are heading, and I've genuinely had to take a rain check on that.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually reflecting, because we've got some really big global roaming news, which we're going to share with you in more detail at the end of this episode, but I was reflecting this week on when we first sat down to record something together ahead of global roaming. We, you know, it was a little 10-minute bit where we kind of talked about what we wanted to do with the show. And I remember I suggested, well, maybe it's possible Donald Trump will end up back in the White House. And you said something along the lines of, I think you're going to try and shock me, Hamish. And I haven't really had to, because I think the world has
done that.
I know,
you were right about his level of disruption. You were right and I was wrong.
When you look back on this year, I'm sort of interested in the highs and lows, but I wonder what has shocked you the most.
I think probably, the biggest shock is to realise that he was actually pro-Putin. He was anti-Europe, he was pro-Putin, and to be candid, I think I became fully aware that he's not particularly interested in Asia. He's much more interested in that Western Hemisphere.
So are you talking about the Zelensky meeting at the White House? Because for me, that meeting, that moment when Trump and J.D. Vance are effectively castigating Zelensky, is that when you realised all of this?
Truthfully, no. It was more the meeting in Alaska when Trump met Putin on that red carpet in Alaska. That is a state of the United States, and took him off in his own little car, the Beast, or whatever, own big car, the Beast. And Putin was fully in the door. And, you know, I had seen Trump give a press conference on the plane where he was saying some very rational things about the complexity of what was to come. He just completely folded. He met Putin face to face and he completely folded. Now, actually, that had a huge impact on me.
I think it's been a particularly interesting year for Australia in this moment of global crisis and change. We obviously had the uncertainty of the new Trump administration, the uncertainty of conflict, particularly in the Middle East, but an election here and a prime minister that was looking quite challenged in terms of his relationship with the US president. But by the end of the year, I think Australia closes it out in a different place to where we were at the beginning. You know, the relationship is intact. We're told AUKUS is secure. Anthony Albanese has had the meetings with President Trump. And on top of that, this social media ban, which, you know, whether you have a particular view on it as an effective piece of policy domestically or not, it's quite an interesting piece of diplomacy. The rest of the world looking at Australia doing something that no one else has.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I hadn't really seen the ban in that light. And then I started to see just what it does portend in terms of a country's sense of itself, that it's the power to do it, and it carries it forward.
Now, you're going to get into the year as we reflect on it with Ravi Agrawal, but before we go to that, I think we can't avoid mention of the huge global conflicts that have unfolded this year, the civilian death toll in the Middle East, in Sudan as well, the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Obviously, it is a positive thing that the level of fighting between Israel and Gaza has reduced. I don't think it's reasonable to really say the conflict is over, but certainly it's moved to a new phase.
Thank God. But it's not over. No, I agree with you.
It is not over. And the geopolitics of that particular region are not settled. Saudi's role, Turkey's role, Israel's dominance of the airspace of the Middle East, all of this has created a dynamic that I think we will have to continue following next year.
Yes, look, I agree. And I do actually think next year we must look a bit more at Africa. There's a lot happening in Africa that is really turbulent. It's sort of a bit of a, I think, a proxy for some of the China, US confrontations, or what would you call them, sort of dilemmas. I think Africa's also growing in also ways that are very interesting, and that's what I'm hoping we can do.
Well, let's get to our guest. Ravi Agrawal is the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. He hosts the podcast FP Live as well, and Geraldine's been talking to him.
Ravi Agrawal, welcome to Global Roaming.
It's great to be with you, Geraldine.
Look, I've just been saying that I think, for me anyway, 2025 was one of the hinge years, you know, akin to 1989, possibly going right back to 1945 or 1848. I wonder if you see it like that, and maybe in sort of articulating your thoughts, you could nominate what you think have been three, say, key moments. Surprise me with your thoughts.
That's a big ask, since you follow the news so closely. Look, I do think it's a hinge year. I think time and history will tell whether it's as big a year as 1989 or 1945, but the signs are all there. And I think part of the reason is that if you look at the grand sweep of history over the last 80 years, if the world was defined by America as the primary superpower, as the real hegemon, there are clear signs now that America wants to step back from that role, at least in terms of being responsible for global order, for rules. But the three moments I would pick, one would be Vice President J.D. Vance's speech at the Munich Security Conference. And that was a moment where we really got to see on the global stage the Vice President of the United States come out and just say publicly, there's a new sheriff in town, and that is Donald Trump. And, you know, he really launched a fairly brutal ideological assault on Europe, which I think was the first real sign of a decoupling of sorts between Europe and the United States, which was a harbinger, I think, for the rest of the year and everything we would see. The second one I would pick would be the G20 summit, which just concluded a few weeks ago in South Africa. Very notable that the United States did not choose to attend the primary global convening that brings together the 20 biggest economies, but also now the African Union. And South Africa did not seem to mind, number one. And number two, it actually was able to bring countries together to put together a joint statement without the United States, as if to say the world is going to get along just fine, even if the United States isn't in the room. And then, Geraldine, if I had to pick a third moment, it would really be a trend line, and we can talk about this later maybe, but I'm really excited about solar energy and the growth in capacity, mostly China-driven. But what excites me the most about it is how that is now being exported to countries around the world, mostly in the global south, and that could have transformative effects.
Well, now, very interesting. We'll come back to that. You didn't mention the Middle East there, Ravi.
You're right, and I could have. But, you know, there's a sense that the Middle East, 'twas ever thus. And you know, even though I think there has been so much change and flux in the region, I think the reason why I didn't mention it immediately is that I am not confident that the current Gaza ceasefire is going to lead to a permanent two-state solution. So on that front, we could be back to not a day after plan, but a day before plan, in that we're back to square one. Before October 7, 2023, we're at October 6. And that is a problem for Israel, of course, which has lost enormous soft power, but also a problem for the Palestinians. I will say, though, Geraldine, There are a couple of things that, if you, again, take a grand sweeping look at the Middle East, that have changed in 2025. One is that Israel has really been able to assert dominance in the region. It is now clearly the region's military superpower. It has attacked several countries in the region. I mean, think of Lebanon, Syria, Tunisia, Qatar, Yemen, but most of all, Iran. And it has decimated Iran's so-called proxies. Think of Hamas, Hezbollah. And so in a sense, the regional power balance has really been transformed.
What about Trump's foreign policy? Let's go there now. In this second administration, he has pursued all these various peace negotiations, some of which are standing up, some of which are not. But he clearly doesn't like multilateralism, while I think a lot of others are coming to realise that that is the way forward. He's basically sort of launched a world global trade war. How do you make sense of these things and where they head? He's got three more years to go in this second term.
It's been very turbulent. Every time you speak to someone in the Trump White House and you ask them what defines their foreign policy, they're going to come back to you with two words: America first. And then your follow-up question is, okay, but what does that mean? And that is very unclear. I mean, they staked a lot of energy around the trade wars and tariffs on a bunch of countries around the world. That hasn't quite worked out. Trump has actually stepped back from some of the key tariffs on coffee, for example, as he discovered that Americans love their coffee. Mm. There are lots of contradictions that define America first. On the one hand, this sense that the United States doesn't want to be interventionist, and yet it has some 20% of its Navy currently stationed off the coast of Venezuela, maybe attacking that country in the next few weeks. So it's hard to really pinpoint what it is that defines Trump's foreign policy agenda. But if I had to point to a couple of things, I would say one is, you know, a sense that the United States has really fallen behind China on critical minerals, and the sense that they really need to try and catch up. So if you want to link, for example, Trump's desire to invade Greenland, Canada, maybe Venezuela, strike deals with Ukraine, pivot to Pakistan, the through line in all of that is actually critical minerals. And it's something we should all be talking about a lot more. And that, of course, links to AI and technology and industry. You can't do any of that stuff without some dominance in critical minerals. And then lastly, Geraldine, there's a real sense now that the Trump administration is a bit of a plutocracy. This is the wealthiest cabinet in the history of the United States. There's some reporting from Reuters that in the first half of 2025, the Trump organization's net worth has gone up by some 1,600%. So, you know, there's a clear sense that if you had to define what this administration is up to, there's a sense that it's tending towards kleptocracy.
Yes. And in fact, one of the things that I would add to your analysis is the lack of certainty. You know, I've realised that I've lived through this virtually my entire life with that sense of the hegemon, meaning the whether or not I liked it, if you know what I mean, the United States. And there were certain certainties about it. Now, that's absolutely vanished. And there is a lot of people have observed that China is perceived to be a far more reliable partner. You might like it, but you know where you're going with them. Doesn't that fundamentally alter the perception of a foreign policy? And if you're trying to decide, you know, where your best alliances, formal or otherwise, rest, if you're a small place like Australia?
Oh, absolutely. I think, again, the reason why this year just feels so pivotal, so historic, is because in the context of the last 80 years, the United States is stepping back from its role as the backstopper of the global order, as the country that ensured, or at least tried to ensure, that everyone was following the rules, even when it wasn't being able to do a perfect job of that itself. China, on the other hand, has become the country now that talks a lot about rules, that talks a lot about global order. You know, but of course, not every country around the world trusts China either. And so the era that we're entering into is sort of a multiplex where, you know, every country is out for themselves. where might sort of works, might is right. Spare a thought, however, for smaller countries. I mean, you know, Australia is still a very big economy, Geraldine, but if you're a Sri Lanka or a Somalia, in that kind of a scenario where countries aren't really incentivized to follow the rules, smaller countries are the ones that suffer the most because they have no recourse. Leaders can act with impunity. And the United States isn't the place you go to arbitrate something because you don't trust them anymore in the same way.
Yeah. Look, we haven't mentioned Ukraine. Oh, I find myself, my heart races when we start discussing Ukraine or I start reading the headlines. And if it's really possible that Russia is going to be rewarded for their aggression. Now, I mean, where do you see those discussions heading over the Christmas period into the new year, which, of course, is right through the winter? You know, my goodness, imagine what all those people are going to go through.
It's terrible, isn't it? I think Trump has made clear that he's not willing to impose too many costs on Russia. One exception came a few months ago when he sanctioned Lukoil and Rosneft, the two big Russian oil companies. But I think the bigger issue here is that partly because Russia's not a democracy, all it needs to win at this point is for the West to lose, to fracture the West. And in that sense, Putin might already be winning in seeing the United States and Europe bicker as often as they are. Mm. I think in terms of where we actually end up with a deal, that could go any which way. But again, Ukraine seems unwilling to give up any territory that it doesn't currently control. So we've had the contours of what a deal might look like, which is that Russia keeps the territory it currently controls, Ukraine keeps what it currently controls. The question has always been, how do you get to a ceasefire and how do you get to longer-term security guarantees?
But that's been
that
obvious for
remains.
Months, hasn't it? That's been obvious
it
for
has.
Months. And all these people are dying because some people can't get over that line. I mean, it's a terrible thing to observe.
It is. Well, ultimately, Putin doesn't want the war to end. If the war ends, he's going to have to reckon with how he didn't get all of Ukraine. And I think that's what it comes down to. He's reached a stage where he's able to sustain a wartime economy. Mm. He is able to travel around the world. I mean, he was in India just last week. He was in China earlier this year. He is able to show his people that he is not a global pariah, despite the best attempts of the Western world.
And what about sustainability? Because into that brew is this gigantic energy transition, which you said you did feel actually quite good about. Why so?
I did. I'm glad you bring that up. Look, I think one of the big trend lines for this year is just the massive advances we've made on the proliferation of solar and wind energy, and specifically solar. I mean, to give you an example, in the month of May, China was able to add new solar capacity for electricity that is as much as what Poland produces in an entire year from all sources. From January to May, it was able to add as much as what Indonesia, a country of more than 250 million people, is able to produce from all sources. So these are crazy big numbers we're talking about in terms of additions of solar capacity. Now, when you look at China then exporting a lot of that cheap capacity to Pakistan or Nepal or countries in Africa, you see a lot of countries that were really sort of foundering on how to manage their energy transitions and then suddenly realizing, you know, it's actually quite cheap to set up a solar panel on our rooftop and we don't have to rely on our corrupt governments to do so. We can just buy it from China. This is an imperfect trend line because sometimes this could come with surveillance from China. You can't always trust China, as we know, but still, it's a big positive trend line.
Wow, that is a big, big bit of speculation. So you're feeling quite good about 2026, aren't you?
I wouldn't say I'm necessarily feeling great about it, but I do like to look on the bright side. And look, the world has shown immense capacity to rebound from tragedies. And I tend to, especially at the end of the year, I tend to try and focus on the human capacity to keep trying to find solutions, even when things look impossible and bleak. And I think, especially on clean energy, if climate change is really the biggest war we're all fighting, and if human ingenuity is showing that, you know, we actually are in a race against time and we could conceivably fix this through technology, then that is a reason to stay hopeful and to fight for something.
Ravi, this is why we like having you on. That's a lovely overview. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, and compliments of the season to you.
Oh, and to you as well, and to Hamish. Thanks for having me on. That was fun.
Well, Hamish, how did you hear all that?
Compliments of the season?
Well, I refuse to just, for people whose backgrounds I don't necessarily know, you know, I think it's an old one, but yes. It doesn't make it just Christmas.
I see.
And so I actually use it. I've reverted to it because I think it's more inclusive.
There I feel like go. I'm in the olden days.
You think it's in the olden days? Well, old is very good. Revisited.
Look, I'm really interested in this idea of this being a hinge year or not, you know, your view. And I thought Ravi was quite interesting on that, because obviously we will only know over time the extent to which this year shapes all of that. But certainly I think reflecting on 2025, the US has stepped back from the function that it has played for the entirety of my lifetime, I think, in a way that no one really quite foretold. Obviously, Trump is a disruptor. We knew there was going to be some of this. But if you put all of these moments together and say that all happened in a year, it's not as clear-cut as a wall falling down, for example. But when you see the accrual of those decisions and those positions, it does start to look like that. Now, who knows what happens next year? Maybe this is not the hinge year.
I remember Kevin Rudd, our ambassador in Washington, said a couple of years ago, this is going to be the decade of living dangerously. He said that, I think, 2 years ago. I've never forgotten that. I think he might be right. We could have about 8 years to go. It's a dangerous time.
Okay.
Now, recommendations, Hamish.
You go first.
I would recommend that people use the whole summer to look at Ken Burns' new series, The American Revolution and Intimate History. It started last week, I think it was, on SBS, and it's their usual brilliant, you know, fabulous voiceover, beautiful use of pictures. It takes you further. It is a joy to watch. You can sit down happily and do that. And look, I'm going to be naughty. I'm actually going to recommend also Robert Mann, who's one of our best thinkers, who actually, because of post-cancer treatment, can't speak on the radio very much anymore. But he's got a Substack now, and he is writing very interesting analysis of Australia, which I commend to people.
I'm going to recommend our summer series, which we put together. That's going to continue dropping in your podcast feed and playing out on Radio National throughout the summer. We've invited 5 Australians, really interesting big thinkers from different sectors, from the media to finance to foreign policy, to come and talk about getting lucky again, where Australia finds its luck in this new, more complicated era. What are the opportunities that we can find amidst all of the global challenges?
Yeah, and they're different. You know, what we want to do was not just rehash all the debates that we have all the time. I mean, clearly we touch upon them, but inviting people to think afresh. And I think they do.
Now, before we go, we have some huge global roaming news, which we've been digesting for the last few months, Geraldine. And that news is that we are expanding quite a lot next year. And I've got to say up front, this is thanks to you, our wonderful and really loyal listeners. So we would like to say thank you. You've turned this show into something much bigger than what we originally envisaged. And so the ABC has decided to do something with that.
So we are going 5 days a week, and we're going to have some new co-hosts. Latika Burke, who actually is an Australian now based in London, so we'll have a global roamer in London and Europe, and I think Europe is going to be a very big story next year.
And also Kylie Morris, who you've heard already on this podcast feed, former correspondent for the BBC in the Middle East, in Kabul, was also North America editor for Channel 4 in the UK, an extraordinary extraordinary career as a foreign correspondent. She'll also be here in your podcast feed each week next year. Geraldine and I will continue doing our thing as well, but you're going to hear a mix of voices, and we are so excited that it's going to give us an opportunity to do more of the stories that you've pointed us towards. So please do get in touch. We'll have more range, more scope, more stories to tell and more voices to tap into. global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address.
Yes, keep pointing us, because that's exactly what we're going to want to know, you know, where you'd like us to go.
And we should also let you know that one of our episodes each week will use your emails. We are going to tap into that. So we're really looking forward to making more of your contributions as well. Huge thank you to our wonderful producer, Taryn Priyadko, who just works her heart and soul out in making this program week in, week out. There's times that I feel like she's stressing so much, her head is going to pop off. But she's also producing a little human,
she
and,
is.
And we're
there's,
so proud of her.
There's a baby arriving just as we actually start the new series. In fact, I've been waiting for it to go into labour. There's so much happening.
But we're so thrilled that we're going to have our first tiny little Roma.
We are going to have a little boy Roma. So, no, look, it's all marvellous times as we head into the summer, and I do hope you're feeling some of that. I know it can be a tricky time this time of the year, but look, we'll be here to accompany you next year. We love your company. Thank you very much indeed. Have a marvellous summer.
Geraldine, and thank you.
Thank you, Hamish. Thank you. We've had a marvellous year together, I think, and it's been a great pleasure. So we'll see you in our summer series, Getting Lucky Again, next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye and Merry Christmas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.